This is a republic if you can keep it, with former Democratic Party Chairman Mark Brewer and former Republican Party Executive Director Jeff Timmer. The presenting sponsor of this week's podcast is Epic MRA Public Opinion Research.
Epic MRA is a Lansing-based market research and public opinion polling firm with nearly four decades of experience accurately measuring public opinion about politics, ballot proposals, and other federal, state, and local issues. Epic MRA is one of the most quoted polling firms in the country. Clients include media outlets, school districts, colleges and universities, state agencies, local governments, labor unions, interest groups, and businesses throughout Michigan. Whether it's measuring voter opinion about who's up or down in elections, or if ballot proposals or legislation can earn voter approval, Epic MRA is known as the go-to Michigan pollster. Visit www.epicmra.com to learn more.
I'm Jeff Timmer.
And I'm Mark Brewer. Thank you for joining us on A Republic If You Can Keep It.
This week, we're going international. Our guest will be Kremlinologist Olga Lautman for some insight on the most hated man on the planet, Vladimir Putin, and his vicious war in Ukraine.
But first, our weekly legitimate political discourse. Jeff, I've been dying to ask you these questions. You know, we have the trip of Marion Sheridan and Meshon Maddock and others down to Trump fundraiser. DiPerno was there. And now they come back and Meshon Maddock, the co-chair of the Republican Party, publicly endorses DiPerno. What the heck is going on in your old party?
Well, there is clearly a move to end this battle for the attorney general nomination, even before the endorsement convention. There is very, I think, legitimate concern that the Chatfield scandal is going to singe, if not embroil, Tom Leonard. There is the crazy faction, crazier faction, I guess. The party itself is crazy, and then there's the crazier faction represented by people like Meshon Maddock and others, said DiPerno, who are feeling their oats right now and feeling strength. You know, as I said a couple of weeks ago, the last time I did the podcast was that the people want to keep writing stories in the news about how Trump's grip on the Republican Party is waning, diminishing the longer he's been out of office. Yet every shred of evidence points to the contrary, that his power and endorsement and in the strength of Trump and the Trump forces in the party is stronger. It's evident, I think, in this attorney general race. I think it's evident in the race that's shaping up between Bill Huizenga and Fred Upton. The you know, Trump's complete and total endorsement of State Representative Steve Kara, you know, that he quickly rescinded when there was a better horse in the race. But I think that shows that Michigan is going to continue to be a focal point of Donald Trump and Trump org and the RNC and Ronna McDaniel and everybody in the Trump orbit, not only at this convention that's coming up, the endorsement convention in April, but in the gubernatorial primary and legislative primaries this summer and in races this fall, they feel that they can get candidates like Matt DiPerno across the finish line in November. I think the rest of the sane world looks at that and thinks, there's no friggin' way these guys are going to win. There's certainly no ability of the Michigan Republicans to do any kind of Glenn Youngkin strategy where they can kind of run parallel to Trump but without actually embracing Trump, because they're all these people who are running are embracing Trump. I mean, you have Perry Johnson going down to Mar-a-Lago and humping Trump's shin along with Matt DiPerno. And so, you know, he's arguably the front runner in the race, at least right now. He's the one spending money. Yeah, there's, you know, Rinky's going to have some money to spend. So a leading candidate is going full on Trump. All the other candidates are embracing Trump. There no one is Glenn Youngkin in the Michigan Republican Party, really at any level.
There's just so many angles on this. I mean, you know, Ron Weiser is the chair of the Michigan Republican Party. We have seen him in the past literally bribe candidates out of races, right? And that caused some legal problems for him in the last couple of years. And, you know, he basically, Maddox does this. I mean, to me, it almost seems like Maddox is the de facto chair of the Republican Party in this state. And Weiser's just kind of there at her suffrage. Am I wrong, Jeff?
No, I've said that since they were elected last February or March, as long as we've been doing this podcast, that despite his past successes as in his two previous stints as party chair and his other accomplishments within business and the party, Ron could not have got elected chair this time without a deal with Michonne Maddox. She's exerting her power even more so this year. And I think that by her, whether she asked for permission or is asking for forgiveness when it comes to this endorsement, she's decided to step out and do this. And I'm sure that there's some... She's not working for free,
right.
You know, so there's already some, you know, transactional deal that's taken place. And you mentioned the Weiser bribed Stan Grott out of the Secretary of State race back in 2018 and didn't really face any legal jeopardy. He just had to pay a monetary compensation to the Bureau of Elections that was double, equal to the amount of money that he used to so his $200,000 bribe cost him an extra $200,000. So for $400,000 he orchestrated the Secretary of State nomination, that candidate lost, anyway, but it wouldn't, if he decides it's worth X amount of zeros to him to do the same thing again, there's really no deterrent. Does Matt DiPerno have a price? That's the only way Matt DiPerno doesn't win the nomination is if he stops running.
Right. And but it seems to me that, there may be more going on with Michonne Maddox and her husband, who's an incumbent rep, right? That the Maddox, I think, aren't they endorsing candidate for state house? I mean, are they trying to assemble here the votes to make Michonne's husband the leader, if not the speaker of the house? Is that going on too, Jeff, you think?
Definitely. Oh, definitely. And there's been accusations. There's been rumors. And I, don't need the burden of evidence to say these rumors are out there, that there is that this is a pay for play deal, that Trump's endorsement, that there's money that goes to Mar-a-Lago, that Mar-a-Lago's kind of larding the balance sheet by charging exorbitant prices to these candidates like Matt DiPerno to come in and do these fundraisers. You have to pay, an extra, five or six zeros to Mar-a-Lago, depending on the size of race that you're in, to get Trump's endorsement. So there's payola there, and then there's also what could be a broker's fee, Sherpas like the Maddox in states like Michigan that say, hey, I've got this, I can call Mar-a-Lago and get you in with the big guy. And so, who knows? But I think there's certainly enough smoke there that if I would like to see the Bureau of Elections start looking into this, because there are implications with the Campaign Finance Act if there's money changing hands with regard to endorsements. So, if there is, it could certainly put candidates afoul of the Michigan Campaign Finance Act. There could be federal implications as well. This is where I start playing lawyer instead of being a lawyer.
Right. Well, Jeff, I don't mean to interrogate you, but, you're the guy on this stuff. I mean, what is the Republican establishment doing to push back? Tom Leonard, I know there are folks out there. I've talked to them as you have, who think this is a disastrous path for the Republican Party in this state. But I don't see any evidence of anybody pushing back, filing a complaint, doing anything politically to try to stop this.
No, the ability of anybody to stop the Trump train in the Republican Party ended long ago. It's just the reality that these people have an iron grip on the party. And when it comes to determining nominees, especially the convention race, where it's a couple thousand party insiders who are the craziest of the crazies who are going to be making this decision, they do not look at this through a pragmatic crystal ball and think, boy, this candidate's demonstrated an ability to get votes and raise money. He's my guy. They think, he says you should eat horse paste and drink urine, and the election was stolen, so he's my guy. That's where they are today.
Yeah, and I think at this convention, the Republicans from my home county of Macomb are going to be leading the charge. I mean, they've been out there on audits. They've been out there on, you know, putting one of their crazy people on the board of canvassers. They endorsed McCoskey, who, you know, won the nomination there in that special election recently. And they, you know, they've been censoring and attacking Republicans all over the state for not being pure enough. It's just amazing to me to see a major political party drinking this quantity of Kool-Aid.
Yeah, and you can see it. R.J. Regan, who won the special election for the state house over in Kent County, who was already very controversial. Things he had said about Ukraine and Putin, about the election, his daughter urging all the voters not to vote for her dad because he was abusive. But then his comment in the last week about on a Zoom that was recorded and broadcast about, if his daughter, he's told his daughters if they're experiencing a rape, they might as well lie back and enjoy it. And you got you've been, in charge of a party. There's a point, Ron Wiser and others in the Republican Party have called him out, but they're calling on him to apologize. There's a point where you just got to say, this is wrong and we can't support this guy and we urge people not to vote for him. I know it's against the self-interest and it's against the typical way this would work. But there's the long-term damage that somebody like that does to the party when the party leaders won't actually stand up. It does more damage in the long run. And the fact that they're unwilling to take him on in a serious way shows how craven and how far they've fallen.
Yeah. Well, why don't we turn our attention to a more conventional internal party battle in my party, in the 13th Congressional District, where the field continues to grow. Recently, we had Portia Roberson get into the race. We've already got a couple of state legislators. There's an educator in there, former police chief in Detroit. I mean, this race just seems to get more and more wide open. We talked a little bit about this with Darcy a couple of weeks ago, Darcy McConnell, who had some observations about it. But, you know, what's your take? I know it's my party, not your former party. But, you know, as an experienced political observer, what's your take when you see a primary field like that?
Well, when you see a primary field like that, and there's a lot of candidates with legitimate claims to certain constituencies, you know, you start looking at how many total votes are there going to be in that primary. There's not going to be a lot. Somebody cobbling together 10, 12, 15,000 votes could conceivably be enough to win a congressional primary. And so that's where you start looking at, it's somebody like Sri Thenadar with all his money. Yes, money makes a difference. They say two things help you win in politics, money and everything else. And money goes a long way toward that, but it only goes so far in a race like this, I think. You know, certainly he can buy his way to a fairly universal name ID easier than other candidates can. But having some grassroots effort organized on the ground is going to be a big difference. And so it seems like this is the kind of race where endorsements and personalities and who's supporting who is going to make a big difference. That seems, there's going to be, Detroit politics, city politics will enter into this, but also this district has expanded into, the suburb area. There's more non-Detroit territory and voters in this district too. And so that's going to be really interesting to see how some of the political players in those areas line up and how some of the traditional Democratic constituencies and organizations line up with their support.
Well, it's very interesting because among all these candidates, and we may be near a dozen by now, they're all from Detroit. There's nobody from outside the city, even though, as you point out, there's now a significant population outside the city. I'm wondering if somebody from one of these suburban communities got in, they might have enough support where they are. And that's what a lot of Detroiters fear, that we're going to get a non-Detroiter and a non-African-American representing this district. But this may be a prescription for that to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be fascinating how this plays out, and there's still a month or nearly a month until the prescribed candidate filing deadline, and so there is the possibility that we could see some additional entrants into the race. I'm thinking somewhere downriver. I don't know if there's a Taylor candidate that's looking at this thinking, how does the math work if I were to be able to consolidate voters in Wyandotte and Southgate and Romulus and in the city of Wayne or Dearborn Heights. When you're looking at that math and being in having it, you don't need 50,000 votes in a primary. You might need 10 or 15,000, and that could make the difference. And so that has to enter their calculus.
Yeah, no, I think that's a definite possibility here as we see this field grow.
Joining the conversation this week is Kremlinologist Olga Lautman. Lautman is a non-resident senior fellow at the Center for European Policy Analysis. She is also the creator and co-host of Kremlin File podcast series, which features expert discussions on the Kremlin's internal affairs, global operations, and tactics used from their hybrid warfare toolkit to destabilize Western democracies.
Lautman's research focuses on the cross-section of organized crime and intelligence operations in Russia and Ukraine, their impact on the West, and the monitoring of active measures campaigns conducted by the Kremlin to destabilize democratic practices and influence foreign elections. Welcome, Olga Lautman, and thank you for joining us on the conversation this week.
Unfortunately, this is right in your wheelhouse. You've been a very vocal critic of Vladimir Putin for years now, and probably were one of the early harbingers of what was coming and what we're all witnessing in Ukraine. So, tell us how you see this now. What are we now, 3 weeks into the fighting?
Well, I am extremely worried because the military strategy for the Kremlin was to take key cities in a few days. Clearly, we have seen that hasn't happened. And the more frustrated the, Kremlin gets, the more you see their tactics changing. And now it's not even a war. Now I just called a series of nonstop terrorist attacks across Ukraine. Like just today in this, the past few hours, there was a theater in Mariupol that was sheltering hundreds of people, and that was bombed. I mean, the theater is gone. And then right like a little while ago, there was another in Mariupol, a public pool that was also indoor public pool, sheltering pregnant women, children, and now that was bombed. And now we have, people trapped under the rubble, women and children. And you see now Russia has changed to basically decimating cities. I mean, they're just going, block by block and bombing apartment buildings and killing civilians.
Yeah, we had a rhetorical, event this afternoon when President Biden called Putin a war criminal. That was the comment from the White House. I don't know that it's going to change anything in the short term, but it definitely changes the tone and the rhetoric by the president accusing Putin directly of war crimes, and it changes the stakes. Keeps ratcheting up the tensions, we're going to be putting more weapons and resources into Ukraine. There's increasing pressures for a NATO enforced no fly zone. There's huge risk with that. There's huge risk without that. And so that's what we have to look at here. And I just wonder how you see the tripwire. What would it take for Western involvement, a no fly zone, for instance?
Well, to go to Biden's comment, Putin is a war criminal. Everything we're seeing play out on media and social media is basically what he did in Syria and Libya and, Central Africa and across. As far as the no-fly zone, I'm not sure. But, I understand the caution of them not wanting, to escalate it by getting into a shooting war with Russia. They also have to understand, Europe and U.S., that if we don't get involved and Putin somehow does win in Ukraine, Poland will be next, or any other NATO country. Russia has a military strategy that they are going by, and it was Belarus, Ukraine, the Baltics, Moldova. They mentioned Poland. So, I mean, if we don't stop him now, the only thing is we'll get involved later on, where you have now mass casualties that could have been avoided. And as far as the tripwire, I worry a lot, and I've been sounding the alarm. I've been collecting data points in Russian media and talking to people. And Russia has been laying the groundwork for both a chemical and a nuclear attack inside of Ukraine. So while people are focused on, you know, Russia shooting off nuclear weapons at the West, they're actually laying the groundwork that the Ukrainian military rigged nuclear plants, which Russia has seized. So that attack could be Putin's exit, and it would give him cover, you know, to cover the 20,000 plus soldiers that are dead. And that's it. And even with chemical weapons, same thing again today. They said that Ukrainian intelligence with the West are preparing a chemical attack. They have been laying this groundwork, and it's not conspiracy sites. This is Russia's defense ministry laying the groundwork for the past several weeks that Ukraine is preparing a chemical attack on their people.
So, Olga, what would that use to be justified then? And would that be used by Putin to justify his own use of chemical weapons, his own use of tactical nuclear weapons in Ukraine?
Absolutely, because prior in years we've seen when the Russian Defense Ministry would warn that there was a chemical weapon about to happen by U.S. or white helmets in Syria, one would happen, but it was by Putin and Assad forces. So here, this is exactly what they would do. They always project what they're going to do. And this is exactly, you know, my biggest worry right now, that they would launch either, well, I don't think they would use tactical nuclear weapons inside of Ukraine and have a chemical attack and, you know, and then blame Ukrainians, but it would be Russians doing it, you know, because Ukraine has zero interest in using chemical weapons on their people. And they definitely didn't wait for 200,000 Russian troops to come in to do so. So, I mean, this is my biggest worry, and this is what Russia does. This is one of their tactics. And as appalling as we see all the images, I mean, they're heartbreaking, they're infuriating. This is how they conduct wars. I mean, this goes back. Putin came into power by blowing up apartment buildings inside of Russia that killed over 300 citizens. And that gave him justification and a pretext to go to war with Chechnya.
So if they were to do that, if the Russians were to do that, would that just be another step toward conquering Ukraine? Or would Putin walk away at that point, saying he's gotten what he came for? How does his mind work? What does he want here, to the extent you can tell us based on your work?
Well, I think his initial intent and what the FSB and the military delivered to him was that he would walk in, because as we saw in the U.S., you know, Putin spent so much resources in cultivating politicians and people inside of U.S. He's done that for two decades inside of Ukraine. So he was given the information. It would be a smooth military strategy. He would put his people in key cities. They would gain control of the cities. That's it. Clearly, that's not happening. So now he's at a point of destruction. If I can't have it, no one will have it. And this is why you see the strategy has shifted now to destroying every single building that exists in Ukraine, you know, killing civilians, destroying churches, destroying schools, hospitals. And I mean, at this point, do you think Russia, with their, you know, ruble worth a penny, is going to spend rebuilding Ukraine? Absolutely not. Now they're at a point that they want to destroy it and punish everyone for, you know, he's lashing out and he wants to punish Ukrainians for not submitting to him.
Yeah, that was it. You know, looking for an off ramp for him, a false flag attack chemical or, nuclear leak from one of the power plants or something like that, that would give them an excuse to kind of go home with their tail between their legs, but, you know, projecting something other than that. I think it seems that they really, Putin and, you know, whoever is in the decision-making circle around him, grossly miscalculated the economic impact of this in just such a short amount of time. It doesn't seem like there's going to be an opportunity for them to participate in the world economic order anytime in the near future. No. No matter what they do. And so that's, you know, that, I guess that leads to more diplomatic uncertainty, because they're, you know, what's to then deter them from further military aggression if there is no economic participation lane with the rest of the world?
I know it's a very difficult thing, but it's long overdue. And look, when Putin went into this, He had a military strategy. He thought Ukraine on their end would, you know, fall and go into his hands. At the same time, he thought the West would, you know, do what they do best and issue deep concerns. And this is what's happened. And we are at this dangerous point because he committed war crimes in Syria, Libya, like I said, Central Africa. He committed several assassination attempts with chemical weapons on foreign soil. He killed Litvinenko with polonium on foreign soil. So he was never held accountable. And I think when he was, you know, planning this operation, he figured that the West, again, would say, oh, you know, we're deeply concerned, put some sanctions, but it would be watered down by lobbyists, you know, across in Europe and in U.S., and he wouldn't face serious repercussions. I mean, I'm as shocked as Putin is. I mean, I didn't think in my lifetime I would see this kind of pushback on this regime. So, yes, it makes him much more dangerous, but at a point, we have to say enough is enough, because if we don't, then we keep giving in. I mean, you see where it is now. You know,
is there a point you mentioned, you know, in Libya and whatnot, that made me think of, you know, Gaddafi was in complete iron-fisted control of that country up until the moment he wasn't. Ceausescu in Romania, and right up until the moment he wasn't. Is there any possibility that those in the hierarchy around in Moscow say enough, you know, that there is that palace coup, that there's that Ukrainian spring that happens? Is there any possibility, or is the Russian structure, is the Russian psyche not built for that?
Oh, there's always, the whole Soviet history is full of, you know, people betraying their leaders and whatnot. No, there's always a possibility. Now, would his higher structure do it because they feel bad for the war crimes they're doing? No, it is because they're, you know, it's a shock to their stability and their own future. So there always is. And you saw, as a matter of fact, this morning, Putin gave the most ridiculous speech threatening about, you know, the fifth column and any traitors. What did he say? Something like they will be flies spit out of the mouth or something to that degree. And yesterday, Roscosmos had Rogozin. He also, you know, carried on about the fifth column and how it is more important to deal with the fifth column than, you know, the progress of the military action and military gains. So clearly there's something happening. And there were also reports inside of Russia that the fifth directorate of FSB that handed Putin, you know, this report of that Ukraine would basically fall and the political situation inside of Ukraine, that there were enough of his people in there to grab control of the country, that they were put under house arrest. So, I mean, Russia is, you know, the history from Soviet Union to Russia, it's a history of betrayal. It's a history of assassinations. And I mean, at any moment, we could see something like that happen. And, you know, we'll see where it goes. As far as the people taking him out, I don't think so. I think, you know, the people, it would take much longer. But who knows? We don't know.
In your view, Olga, how effective are the sanctions? I mean, you know, you just described what may be some internal pushback based on the sanctions. You know, but you know, you're very knowledgeable about the Russian economy and all these issues. Are the sanctions that the West has imposed so far, are they going to bite? And if so, how soon?
Absolutely, they're biting already. The day that the U.S. announced SWIFT, that morning, it was a Saturday night here, that morning on a Sunday, there was a queue of people running to the ATMs. So, I mean, there was a run on the banks, you know, on top of it. A lot of people in Russia, you know, grew up after or were born towards the end of the Soviet Union or after it collapsed. So the fact to have Apple Pay, Google Pay, Nintendo, PlayStation, everything that they've grown up with taken away from them, it is having a huge impact. And I mean, then on top of it, you know, the mortgage rates, now they're double. So you have it affecting, I mean, this is where you might actually long-term see a shift with Russians turning against Putin because they're affecting them. I mean, Russians, you know, could care less if Putin's committing war crimes, but the minute it hits their household where their pensions aren't going to be paid, their salaries are going to be cut or not paid, you know, that is when you're going to see an effect. And it's already happening. And I can tell you, I remember during COVID, at the beginning of COVID, there were several months that the Kremlin wasn't paying salaries to people. And it was beginning to start protests and people went on strike. And, you know, I mean, it was a lot of action across the region, across different regions. So I think immediately right now we're seeing the effect. And especially even with the oligarchs, Israel took the move, you know, participate in sanctions. And you saw Abramovich, one of Putin's money people, fly out of Israel in what, like a few hours to Turkey and then back to Moscow. So, I mean, all his oligarchs that he created, their money is being seized, their properties are being seized, their yachts are being seized. And now, I mean, they're going to be trapped inside of a failing state with an iron curtain that is even worse than the Soviet Union.
It seems the only valve of opportunity for Russia is China. China supplying them with potential with weaponry and with goods. And, you know, China is clearly watching the West's response, the world's response to the situation in Ukraine with their long desire to repatriate Taiwan. And, you know, I think that the fact that China is a much bigger player with a footprint in the world economy, you know, so different than what Russia had, is going to be a deterrent to them taking this, you know, any aggressive action of their own. But I wonder how long, you know, it would seem like Xi has the power to stop this, maybe more than anybody else does with one call to the Kremlin. You know, is there any possibility of something like that happening, or do they want Russia weakened militarily?
I think Xi actually would want Russia weakened militarily. I mean, he's not stupid. He sees, thank God that we had the response we did towards Russia, because you are absolutely correct. China was watching. And if we would have handed over a weak response, to Taiwan would have been next. Being that he sees this, do I think Xi is going to invest into a failing state? I don't think so. I mean, at this point, you know, you don't have to even be that knowledgeable or have that good intuition to see that Russia's on a sinking ship right now. And so as far as he might provide some assistance, but for him at the same time, he doesn't mind it going a little bit further because it does weaken Russia's power. And, you know, and then for him, that's what he wants, weaken powers across. Do I think he'll 100% commit to Putin? Absolutely not. And look, Russia's money was parked everywhere in the West. They didn't park it in China. They parked it in the West because they knew it was safe here. I don't see them, you know, their oligarchs moving the money there or, you know, because it's another dictatorship and every dictator is paranoid and they know what dictators are capable of. So it'll be interesting to see that angle. But the most it will do is prolong Putin's war for a few extra weeks. Because at this point, I don't even know how long he's going to be able to run this war with, you know, the economic collapse that's happening inside of Russia right now.
Oh, that seems like we're in a contest of wills here, right? I mean, you know, and you know this better than I do, I'm sure. Western Europe is extremely dependent on natural gas and oil from Russia. How long before their resolve begins to weaken as prices increase? You know, oil and natural gas get much more difficult to find. It may have and it will have an economic impact on Western Europe economies. I mean, so who wins the battle of wills here? Just like the Russian people you described have become used to these various, you know, I'll just call them comforts, you know, these material possessions. People in the West are also used, right, to having warm homes and an economy and a job. So when do folks in Western Europe start to weaken, do you think?
You know, in this situation, they might not weaken. Maybe they'll, you know, try. But look, this for anyone in Europe, this is extremely reminiscent of World War II. And as long as we see the war crimes and children and women, you know, being killed. And now, I mean, it will be upwards of 5 million, you know, refugees who have fled Ukraine. This, you know, for them, I think, especially with the people, and you've seen the outpouring of support from Germans, from Polish, from the French, from anyone, you know, opening their homes and opening their wallets to Ukrainians to help them. So as long as these war crimes happen, and I mean, we're only seeing them get more deadly, I don't think the German government is going to stick out their thumb and say, you know what, we're going to have to pay double for our energy right now. I mean, considering that people have left with one bag and are walking like 3 days to a border into a future unknown, and the people who are trapped are being just murdered, you know, in mass numbers. So I think in this situation, we're not going to see it as much, maybe behind the scenes, but publicly, I don't think that'll happen.
What's your assessment of the performance of the Ukrainian president so far? I mean, frankly, you know, I think from those of us who don't watch these things very closely, very much a surprise, right? In terms of he didn't flee. He's been, seems to be a real master at, you know, the public presentation. He constantly invokes, you know, Hitler and other historical, you know, metaphors. You know, but what's your assessment of his performance and what he's done so far?
Oh, I think he is doing a great job as far as getting the information, because when Russia attacked Ukraine in 2014, Russia, over the past 8 years, has done so much to demonize Ukraine between Nazis, between, you know, they started the war in 2014 because Ukrainian military, they claimed, which were lies, crucified a three-year-old boy. And I mean, there have been over 4,000 stories debunked of fake news, fake videos, fake pictures. And here, and Russia has always held the narrative. I mean, you see, even in the United States, Russia wins with the narrative. They direct the narrative. And here you have Zelensky, who came out, and it's Zelensky and Ukrainians. And they are getting the truth out. And they are getting the truth out in such a powerful way that Russia's disinformation is kind of being like put into the back, which is a first in 20 years that I've seen, because Russia always wins the information war. Here, they are losing. And for the most part, with everyone, U.S. has a biological weapon laboratory, which is a lie, inside of Ukraine. You'll have 10, you know, videos of women being carried out or homes being blown up or something like that. So I think with him, the way he's appealing, I mean, I don't remember a world leader going, you know, like parliament to parliament, Congress, and appealing directly to them and sitting there in his war outfit, you know, his T-shirt. He's not dressed up. It's not a presentation. He's sitting there on the ground and saying, you know, I need help. So I think he definitely captivated the world's attention. And I mean, and I think just seeing Ukrainians fight so hard, that also captivated the world's attention.
I could ask you, put yourself in Ukraine's position. What would you be agreeable to end this? I mean, can it be ended? Is there some compromise? Jeff mentioned off-ramp a little bit ago, and there's been a lot of talk of that. Is there some negotiated end here, something that Ukraine can live with and that Putin can live with and that he saves face? Is it? Is there such a thing?
There's no such thing. And honestly, as Ukrainians, they will never compromise on anything. This is their own land. This is their own territory. This is their freedom. This is their fight for democracy. It's like if Canada decided to come into U.S., you know, brutally assault and murder children and women and people fleeing in humanitarian corridors, and then they back up and we're like, okay, you know what, take a few states. You know, this is a sovereign country. They should not negotiate with a terrorist or with anyone for the matter. This is their land. There's a long history between Ukrainians and Russians going back to Stalin. They will not compromise one bit, nor should they compromise. And even if any political leaders ever attempt to compromise, the civil society will, you know, quickly throw them out like they did with President Yanukovych and any other figure who, you know, attempted to do something against the will of the people.
One thing that, you know, we were focused on the conflict within Ukraine, you know, given the ability for cyber attacks, for disinformation on social media, what kind of thing should we be on the alert for? What is the Western defense agencies focusing on to prevent what might Russia try to do to disrupt things in the West digitally?
Oh, absolutely. I think cyber attacks are first and foremost, because for what we're doing to their economy, I mean, they've attacked us and conducted some of the biggest cyber attacks over the past several years without us even doing a thing. So here, the fact that they're sanctioned and that, you know, their money flow has been cut, they definitely can come after our, you know, power plants. They can come after our power grid, our financial institutions, our telecommunications. And again, Ukraine was the testing ground for all of this, the disinformation. Disinformation, I don't see it being as, you know, I'm not as worried about their disinformation attacks in U.S. right now or their interference in this election cycle, because right now, you know, we're kind of a drop more united. But I do worry about the cyber attacks. So, I mean, for US, I think that is the number one thing that they need to monitor. And also they need to monitor, you know, any operatives on our soil who might commit some kind of sidetrack attacks where, you know, to distract us. So I think that those are the two things I would worry about.
Why hasn't Putin done that already? Olga, why have not we seen those cyber attacks? Maybe they've occurred and they've been blocked, or maybe the U.S. government isn't talking about them. But, you know, we're 3 weeks into this, and like you said, the West and the U.S. have shown surprising resolve and provided enormous assistance, short of going to war with Russia. What is Putin waiting for? Why isn't he already engaging in these cyber attacks, in your view?
I actually, same thing, thought that he would start already. I have a feeling maybe being that we knew, because I was, you know, warning about this war since February of last year. I'm sure our intelligence agencies, you know, are just as privy, if not more privy to information. So I think that maybe they were preparing and securing everything. But I have the same question. I mean, unless we're extremely prepared for it, I would have thought that Putin would, you know, launch an attack soon. Maybe he's waiting for our guard to go down, you know, and maybe do it in a few weeks. Maybe he's too occupied right now. Maybe he recruited his cyber criminals to be put onto the battlefield of Ukraine. I mean, but I still, like, I wouldn't let our guard down. And I've been warning people for months, even before starting in January, that, you know, people need to have cash on hand, gas tanks full, and just to be prepared in case we sit without electric for a week or several days, or the banks go offline or something like that.
Do I assume correctly that the U.S. has the ability to massively retaliate in the cyber world as well, if that were to occur? Maybe that's deterring Putin. What do you think?
I mean, we've always had that ability, because if they shut our lights off, we can shut, you know, Moscow's lights off in a minute. So they've always had the ability. You know, that's one thing I'm not sure, because I've been myself, you know, like strangely, like anticipating a cyber attack. And for now, it seems to have be quiet. Again, maybe our agencies knew this was coming and had, you know, time over the past year to make sure to protect and prop up and put all the firewalls, at least to all the crucial things.
Right.
Hmm. Well, I want to, when we have a little bit of time left, why don't you tell us a bit about the Kremlin File and your podcast, and so that folks can find that and listen to your great podcast.
Thank you. So I have a podcast, Kremlin File. You could catch up on episodes on KremlinFile.com. And it basically covers everything about Russia, going back to the collapse of the Soviet Union and then going forward. And it covers their operations in Ukraine and how Ukraine was a testing ground, all the hybrid warfare tactics that they've you know, deployed against the West. And one of the reasons I did it was because over the past several years, our media framed everything as, you know, like Russia's attack on U.S. was Republican versus Democrat. He said, she said. So I did this podcast to show, no, we were the 27th country who was under some kind of an attack by Russia. You know, and they've interfered in every single election in Europe. I mean, in Montenegro, they attempted to assassinate the prime minister because they wanted a new one. So I want people to learn what Russia's capabilities are, how they run their disinformation campaigns, how they move their money, how they fund these operations. So this is a series. Season two was supposed to be on U.S. and Russia, Russia's attack on U.S. But with everything unfolding with Ukraine right now, I'm taking the space dedicated to people inside of Ukraine so they could give their accounts. And so we have more documentation of war crimes and, you know, and kind of the humanitarian aspect of these people inside Ukraine who are have to live and document things under bombs.
Well, it's fascinating and powerful. I urge people to subscribe and listen. So thank you for joining us this week. It's, you know, like it's too bad that your expertise is so in demand right now. We thank you for taking the time.
Yeah, Olga, thank you very much.
Hopefully it'll get better. Hopefully there's a miracle that happens.
Well, thank you. Your insights have been so helpful. Thank you. It's been very, very informative.
Thank you.
That's our time for this week. Our great thanks to Olga Lautman for her expert analysis of Putin's war in Ukraine.
Join our weekly conversation. Send us an email, comments@arepublicpodcast.com.
And if the Republic is still standing, we'll be back in a week. I'm Mark Brewer.
And I'm Jeff Timmer. See you next week.
You can subscribe to A Republic If You Can Keep It on all major podcast sites. A Republic If You Can Keep It is a production of Michigan Citizens for a Better Tomorrow.